There we go. I'm going to start out tonight's talk with a little bit of an analogy. When I was in my 20s, I was, as were the times then, I was really quite heavily fascinated by leftist philosophy. And one of the questions I was really fascinated by that I devoted a lot of my attention to was this question that has been of interest to lefties over the years, which is given how unequal the distribution of capital is and this economic system, and how uneven the distribution of assets are. Why is it that people continue to not only not revolt or do anything, but also people even are easily persuaded to vote for parties that are actively working against their own interests? For instance, why do working class people so often vote for the Republican Party? And the answer that came about in many leftist circles was concepts of what's known as hegemony and alienation, which is basically hegemony is the ability of all of the institutions, cultural, media, entertainment, all of the media that we consume, the educational systems, everything basically legitimizes the economic system that we live in. And so basically, in a sense, from a leftist perspective, we're kind of all brainwashed. We buy into this belief that people deserve everything that they get, that there's nothing arbitrary or, unfair about it. That it's a pure meritocracy. So anyway, neither here nor there. This is not a spiritual center, not a center where, but it's an analogy. And then so the leftists also proposed something called alienation, which is that to use the arts as a way to sort of jolt people out of this sort of trance-like state and see the radical disproportionate nature of the distribution of wealth. Now, the Buddha was interested in a very similar phenomenon, but from a spiritual angle. The question spiritually is, given the nature of life, the First Noble Truth, which is, as summarized in the chanting that Theravadins do, we are all of the nature to grow old. We're all of the nature to experience illness. All of us will die, and we'll all experience separation from things that we love. Given that, yet we still spend so much of our lives caught up, overbalanced, trying to attain approval, monetary gain, careers, cultural capital. Things that, while they're fine in building up nice reputations for ourselves, when it comes to dealing and coping with life's big challenges, these things that we preoccupy ourselves with are absolutely useless. Absolutely useless. Now, that's not to say that they don't have their use in terms of paying the rent. A career is pretty good when it comes to that, and of course, we like approval. We like having things. And money makes us feel financially, of course, secure. It certainly has its privileges in the world. But when it comes to the inevitable big issues that we'll face, when people face them, either their own mortality or the great losses that we all experience, whether deaths of people that are close to us, or divorces, or sudden ends of careers. I mean, the first noble truth can happen in so many different ways. And they're not limited to old age. When it comes to facing and making sense of what life is all about, and how can we live with these experiences and maintain a state of poise and peace of mind, all of the financial wealth in the world doesn't do very much good. All of the Facebook friends, the likes that our postings get, all of the iPads and iPods and the endless streaming of media and the reputations that we work so hard to foster, garnish, our resumes, all this stuff really doesn't help at all. There's some wonderful books, Lessons of the Dying, for example, where they interview people who are facing mortality, and they all say that none of that stuff has any importance whatsoever. And even if you've ever been through a jolting experience in life, you know this to be true, that the approval that you get at work, or the furniture in our apartments, the things that we get bent out of shape about so often, really don't resonate very deeply or come as a solace when it comes to dealing with separation, grieving, loss, rejection. So, boy, this sounds grim, doesn't it? Okay, I'll keep going. I was in a fine mood when I came here, and I'm like, oh, jeez. Words coming out. I'm like, oh, boy. But capitalism and our society is great. It's continually pumping out shiny new things. And we have medical technology and breakthroughs that statins and all kinds of drugs that allow us to have the possibility of living longer lives. So it's very easy to think, well, hell, I'm in my 30s. This is depressing. I don't want to think about this. I just right now want to get my career together, and I can deal with that other stuff later. And, you know, sure, I mean, I'm sure that one day I'll have to deal with it. But, of course, then suddenly it's not so distant. It actually, loss and all the big issues we have to face come very fast and heavy with each passing year, and before we know it, we're facing some very important challenges that very often in life, if we've been caught up in just producing, whether it's producing art or producing work or whatever, it still doesn't help us make sense of it all. So, yet we're still very invested on the world. It keeps us pointed in the direction of just keep your chin up. keep a determined good look on your face. You know, buckle up. We have so many phrases along those lines. Roll up the sleeves, and that's when the tough get going and all that shit. So, and when people do talk about this stuff, it can feel like, oh, what a party pooper. Oh, my God, that guy's such a downer. That's not fun. I want to hear happy stuff. I work hard. I don't want to be reminded of, you know, all despite how hard I'm working, that, you know, there's stuff that I'm completely not looking at. So, virtually every single spiritual path, not just Buddhism, is founded upon a great moment of alienation when someone or a group of people stop for a moment and realize, holy shit, all this stuff I've been fixated on, it's not helping me prepare for the deeper issues of life, the more existential, as it were, dilemmas and moments that I will certainly have to face. Muhammad was worked, I think, as a tradesman, he was a merchant until he was in his late 20s. Noah, I gathered, was a normal guy, and then he heard his spiritual calling. Certainly with the Buddha was for 28 years living in Kapalivatsu, a palace, surrounded by youth and beauty and art and culture and music and surrounded by beautiful women, and was completely enmeshed for a while in that life. And then he had a couple of very core deep experiences where he deeply saw the nature of life, the nature of aging and illness, and he saw through the transitory forms of beauty that he was surrounded with, and saw that said that one night when all the beautiful young people he surrounded with fell asleep, he was awake and he saw them and they looked like corpses to him, because he saw just how quickly this beauty was going to fade. So this leads us to a moment of Samvega and Nibbida. Samvega is the experience of, holy shit, I've been spending my life just so overbalanced on my work or on my social relationships or my family or just on my art or just on this external stuff. I've just been focused on this. And it's completely left me with this feeling of emptiness when it comes towards dealing with this crisis that either I am going to face, or I am facing, or I see my friend facing. It's just this moment of, and it hits us. Sometimes it just happens when we have spent all of our time in a career and suddenly it implodes, which happens all the time. Or in a relationship that we've devoted so much of our efforts towards, and then the relationship implodes, or what have you. People can devote all their time to their art and then one day wake up and feel estranged from it. So This is Samvega, this feeling of being almost like being punched in the gut. And it's followed by Nibbida, which is a feeling of alienation, seeing that all this stuff of the world, while it has its role, and it can be beautiful, and it can be an important part of life, but if we attach to it and focus all of our efforts onto it, then we've completely led an imbalanced life. That we're asking these things to make us feel like our life has had a purpose and a point, when they can only go a very small distance in that direction. When people are at the end of life, the questions they ask are, did I love well? Was I close to the people that I I cared about? Did I give of myself? Did I take care of myself? Did I hold back when I wanted to take risks? Did I take did I take time to know myself? All these questions that all the endeavors in the world do not answer. So nibbida is this feeling of almost an estrangement. The word literally means disenchantment. It's very similar to the alienation that the lefties were talking about, where you stand back and you say, oh wait, this doesn't make sense. It's this feeling of, oh, I've been so worked up about work and all this shit in my job, and now suddenly I'm facing this issue, which makes it all seem so meaningless, so unimportant. And I wish that I had been spending a little bit more time just developing peace in my own experience, my own mind, my own being capable of bringing calmness to myself. Because I'm so reactive, so pinned to the world, that now I don't know what to do. So, nibbida is very much not a mistake or a problem or a signal that something's wrong. In fact, it's a signal that something finally right is happening. When we have this great moment of doubt, of holy shit, this is not as important as I thought. Why am I getting so bent out of shape? This doesn't mean that we're going through a nervous breakdown necessarily. It could be part of one, I suppose, but it's not a signal of that we should go and just find something new, external, to become preoccupied with. It's very humorous that one of the funny cultural jokes is when men have their midlife crises. They wake up in a 50-year-old body, you know, hair gone, belly. And so they get rid of their first wives and hook up with somebody younger and get a flashy car. So basically they're just buying time. They don't want to look at death. They don't want to look at the fact that they're aging. They just want to surround themselves with new shiny stuff so that they can basically not have to face. And we all, for a long time, jump from distraction to distraction to distraction so that we don't have to really experience nibbida, which is a sense of, you know what, this career, it's nice, it's wonderful, I enjoy it while I do it. While I'm there, it's really wonderful, but it's not all of what my life should be about. Nor is this relationship. And when we spend so much of our time trying to, on these campaigns to get relationships or to get a special career, boy, are we disappointed when they don't fill us up with a sense of purpose and security. They don't make loneliness go away. So, nibbida is best actually cultivated, rather than waiting for some like existential crisis to kick in and then to be completely thrown about. Some of the regular things is when I found myself getting bent out of shape with anything, of the world, like chasing approval, chasing security from external things, trying to chase any kind of gain, as I ask myself, well, is this the kind of thought that I would really want to be my last thought? Would I feel really good if this was the last thought that I think? Or if this thought, this kind of bent out of shape, if this was a being, what kind of being would it be? A lot of my thoughts would be like these snarling, like a rabid dog just trying to get its bone. Or, you know, I can reflect on when I see people who are caught up, overbalanced in certain directions, do they look happy? Do they seem serene? Or are they overreactive? Are they easily, you know, tricked by the smallest event that happens in their jobs or their relationships or their friendships? Invariably they are. So these reflections are really quite useful, because the whole point of Nibbida is that it sends us back again and again and again to rebalancing our efforts towards the spiritual, which is A, reflecting on times that we've been generous and kind and compassionate with ourselves and others. And if those things don't come to mind readily, well, it's time to focus on that part of our lives. To focus on developing a meditation practice so that I have the ability, no matter what's going on in the world, to calm the body, the breath, feelings, moods. Mindfulness throughout the course of the day, practicing softening so that I'm not reactive. I'm not overbalanced towards what people are saying and doing. I'm not hyper-reactive. I have a balanced experience. Reflecting on impermanence. That time does pass so much faster than we can really, or are led to believe. All these reflections are really, really important in developing these tools. The core tool, probably beyond meditation and mindfulness, is also what the Buddha called upekkha, which is a balance. Knowing how much we can be involved in our jobs. How much can I be involved in the dramas of my friends? How much can I care about those phone calls from people that are upset about this boyfriend or girlfriend or this thing that somebody said or whatever? How much can I extend outwards before I'm being baited and pulled and yanked around by the world? Always taking time to pull my awareness back in and make sure that I'm aware of what's going on inside of me and diligently caring for myself as much as I'm caring about the shit that's going on all around me. The more I do that, the more I develop a spiritual balance that will come in so important in the future. The key to the Buddha's teachings on karma is that everything we think, everything we do is planting the seeds for what the mind will experience in the future. We see this every time we sit down and we meditate. If we've been rushing about and plowing through life and experiencing other people as obstacles, then when we sit down to meditate, the body and the mind just doesn't settle down. We're inheriting the remains or the residue of all that anxiousness and that stress. If, on the other hand, we've been calm and we've been a little bit detached and a little bit removed from all the drama around us, then when we sit down, we're much more capable to bring the mind into the present. We're not yanked about by all these narratives about what's going on all around us. It works in a small time scale and it works on a large time scale. If we spend our lives caught up in external dramas, campaigns for financial gain, all that stuff, then when it comes time in life to deal with loss and separation and finding a meaning when a lot of the things we've been clutching to are taken away, it won't be that easy. and the mind will not be peaceful. But if we plant the seeds for a peaceful, calm, appreciative mind, a mind that appreciates all the efforts we put into things that have deeper meaning, like generosity and compassion, being kind, being peaceful, even to people we don't know, then that is a mind that will feel that the life we've spent has had purpose. That there has been a point. And it will be a much easier experience for us. So, that is a little bit on Nibbida. Why it plays such a central role in the story of the Buddha, and why it does not need to be experienced as something to be dreaded or worried about, but rather it is something that can point us radically in the right direction. So I hope there was something worth thinking about tonight, and I thank you for listening, and now it's time for any questions that anyone might have.
When I think about